Good evening. This is 91.3 KUAF, a listener-supported service of the School of Journalism and Strategic Media at the University of Arkansas. This is Ozarks at Large for Tuesday night, March 24th, 2020. Ahead tonight, the efforts to crack down on COVID-19 scams across Arkansas, how a pandemic affects people living without permanent shelter, and our militant grammarian explores words and phrases inspired by our canine friends. Tonight, after this program, stay with 91.3 KUAF for a live conversation about the latest developments regarding COVID-19. NPR, All Things Considered, and KUAF are offering a nightly live program that is a national conversation about the most recent developments during these highly unusual times, and it's a place for your questions to be answered. The live national conversation from NPR, All Things Considered, and KUAF begins at 8 tonight, right after this evening edition of Ozarks at Large. Fayetteville Mayor Lionel Jordan is implementing additional regulations connected to the attempts to slow the spread of COVID-19. He announced today city permit fees for fishing on Lakes Fayetteville and Sequoia are waived through Sunday. That's the same time frame as a waiver for fishing fees throughout the state. City park amenities in Fayetteville are closed until further notice, and groups on city park property that are not practicing distancing are prohibited. Closures include basketball and other playing courts, playing fields, playgrounds, water fountains, restrooms, and gazebos, and any other amenity where social distancing is not being observed. City trails are remaining open at this time, and Walker Park restrooms are remaining open. And the city's ban on disposable single-use polystyrene foam products now delayed until July 1st. Crystal Bridges Museum of American Art and the Momentary, both in Bentonville, will now remain closed until April 17th. In a press release this morning, it was announced the closure dates will be assessed daily and updates will be made available to the public. And word today that Washington County Sheriff Tim Helder's test for coronavirus after he put himself in isolation came back negative. He had taken the measure after learning of possible exposure. The negative result news was shared through the Washington County Sheriff's Facebook page. Good evening. This is Ozarks at Large. The first deaths due to COVID-19 in Arkansas are now being reported. Governor Asa Hutchinson announced the first two deaths at an afternoon press briefing. Dr. Nate Smith, director of the Arkansas Department of Health, says neither death was a nursing home patient. Both victims were in central Arkansas. Dr. Smith says one person in his 50s, the other victim older than 80. Governor Asa Hutchinson began the briefing with a somber message.
Today I've had meetings with hospitals. I've had meetings with counties lately, legislators, but in dealing with and talking to my public health team, they use this language and said that what we're seeing is the calm before the storm. Now, I know that many people don't see this as the calm, but I think the way that is phrased makes us understand that we're still on the lower end of the slope as it goes up.
The governor says this morning the state received its second allocation of personal protective equipment, or PPE, from the National Strategic Stockpile. He says the order included nearly 28,000 masks. An additional million units from other orders should start arriving this weekend. Enough, he says, to cover the state for the next 60 days at current usage rates. If, as expected, the number of cases rises, the exhaustion of those PPE will come sooner. The governor is asking for a special session of the state legislature to convene Thursday.
This is important to make sure that we can continue to meet the essential needs of the state government during this emergency health crisis that we have. And so that is why this is urgent action. It is important to get everybody together in a quick fashion to be able to make the budget adjustments that are needed. The proclamation and the legislation is being prepared as we speak. I do not intend to issue the proclamation until we have a consensus from the legislature on exactly the legislation and the support for that.
The governor says the legislative branch and the public health team are working on ways to make sure proper steps are taken to keep lawmakers and staff as safe as possible as they gather for a special session. The governor says he's also being asked why he's not closing businesses or ordering a shelter-in-place edict, as other states have done to slow the spread of coronavirus. He says he's talked with other governors and examined Arkansas' status, and says he believes the state is approaching the pandemic correctly with guidance from Dr. Nate Smith and the Arkansas Department of Health and other members of the state's public health team.
You have to ask the question, if you go further and close more, when do you open them up when you know that we're going to be in this situation for 8 to 12 weeks, even before it starts peaking?
The governor used the briefing to again stress the need to avoid unnecessary travel, practice social distancing of at least 6 feet from each other, and keeping social gatherings to fewer than 10 people. Dr. Nate Smith says for the first time, more positive tests for COVID-19 are coming back to Arkansas from private labs rather than state tests. Three new counties, Pike, Hempstead, and Cross, have had first confirmed positive test results in the past 24 hours. Dr. Smith also says Arkansans need to think about some difficult decisions.
Funerals. It is very important that we remember our loved ones and that we honor their lives. But funerals can also be a time when COVID-19 can pass easily amongst family members, and especially if there are older or vulnerable individuals at the funeral. I think we need to think about ways that we can honor the lives of our loved ones in a way that doesn't increase the spread of COVID-19. I think that perhaps smaller family gatherings, maybe even outside as the weather gets better, and then maybe putting off a larger memorial service to later on.
Dr. Smith says there is increasing evidence that smoking greatly enhances the dangers, including death, from COVID-19. Dr. Jennifer Dillehay, the state's medical director for outbreak responses and immunizations, says she wants Arkansans of all ages to understand how serious social distancing is.
It is hard for many young people to stay away from their friends because our friends are very important to us. But if they are truly important, it's going to be important for us to use social distancing to protect ourselves as well as our friends.
Updated statistics about coronavirus tests and more, including county-by-county numbers, can be found at the Arkansas Department of Health's webpage, and complete press briefings can be seen at the YouTube page for Governor Asa Hutchinson. KUAF 91.3 is carrying as many of those briefings from Little Rock live on our station as we're able. This is a Tuesday evening edition of Ozarks at Large. The University of Arkansas for Medical Sciences began COVID-19 testing yesterday, but as more options for testing become available, officials say Arkansans need to be aware they're using legitimate services. Ozarks at Large's Antoinette Grajeda reports.
UAMS Chancellor Dr. Cam Patterson says Arkansans are being approached with offers of rogue tests, medications, and supplies.
And unfortunately, in difficult situations, some people try to take advantage of the circumstances that we are in. So I would remind everybody in the community to be mindful that there is one true source of information, and that's what we are trying to provide here. But if somebody provides you with an offer for something that doesn't make sense or seems too good to be true or is preying on your fears and concerns, please be wary about that.
Arkansas Attorney General Leslie Rutledge issued a press release Friday alerting the public to scammers going door-to-door targeting senior citizens. Posing as Centers for Disease Control and Prevention employees, the scammers knock on doors and offer to scan people for COVID-19 for $50. According to officials, these people, who are not licensed medical professionals, swab your nasal cavity and pretend to perform a medical test while you watch. To obtain results, they ask for banking information, including credit and debit card numbers and Social Security numbers. In a press conference, Rutledge said her office has been contacted about the scam.
At least one individual has approached an elder person's home claiming to be from the CDC or another health provider and stating that they would perform a test and be charging that individual money. Not only does this put that elder person at health risk, it also threatens their financial resources and the opportunity to steal money and their identity.
Rutledge says no one from the Arkansas Department of Health or the CDC is making house calls. If Arkansans are approached by people who say they're with these organizations and are offering a home test, Rutledge says they should call local law enforcement. The Attorney General's office has also received information on fake websites trying to take advantage of people during the pandemic.
There are literally thousands of fake coronavirus and COVID-19 websites. These are phishing scams where people are attempting to get your personal information, your Social Security number. Please use our Department of Health website and the CDC website for information about COVID-19.
Rutledge's office is also monitoring price gouging. During a state of emergency in Arkansas, the law prohibits businesses from charging more than 10% above the pre-disaster price of goods or services. Rutledge says so far, her office has received approximately 185 complaints.
Fortunately, not all of those have been active complaints. Some of them have been fake individuals who have posted something on Facebook as a joke. Please do not post on Facebook or social media if you are joking about selling an item at an exponential rate, because you will get a call or an email from my office. That being said, we have about 24 active investigations ongoing on price gouging.
If you want to report instances of price gouging or scams tied to the COVID-19 pandemic, you can do so at the Arkansas Attorney General's website, arkansasag.gov. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
As many of us social distance from home, some in our community are unsheltered or living in temporary shelters during the outbreak. Ozarks at Large's Susanna Sitek recently spoke with John Gallagher, the chair of the Northwest Arkansas Continuum of Care and assistant professor at the School of Social Work at the University of Arkansas. Their discussion included how local organizations are providing services and support to those experiencing homelessness in the time of coronavirus.
What is the situation on the ground in the region in terms of organizations helping our vulnerable populations, people who are unsheltered, maybe living in tents, or people who are using shelters temporarily or overnight?
So to start with folks who are experiencing acute outdoor homelessness, you know, it's interesting. So we have a weekly conference call that we're trying to work through COVID-19 and coordinate amongst homeless providers and also bringing in liaisons from the healthcare system. And so when we were talking about the needs of unsheltered people, it's interesting. The needs are there and the awareness is being raised, but they just live in such acute crisis that it's some of the folks who are trying to do outreach with them say it's actually they're a little less connected to the crisis than the rest of us, which makes sense and is just a sad reality of how day-to-day they live with crisis. But, you know, they lean heavily on our soup kitchens, our day shelters. Most of those providers in town are having to, if they haven't already, they're actively discussing no longer providing congregate services because of fear of disease transmission. They're all working hard and smart, and we're coordinating on still making ways to make food and other supportive services available to them via outreach to the camps or having places where people can come in to get food or other services. But there's those types of acute needs.
And what about organizations that provide shelter, either overnight or temporary? How is this impacting them?
Yeah, so what the shelters have started doing is, you know, we've been calling resources. Our federal partners, HUD, is doing a very nice job of kind of pushing out best practices that, you know, they're developing in partnership with the CDC, you know, other federal agencies. The VA is coordinating. There's some nonprofits that have a national emphasis on healthcare, National Healthcare for the Homeless Council. So HUD's doing a great job of pushing out documents, model screening tools. So our shelters have started screening people to identify people who are most at risk and are still, at this point, they're still providing services. They're, of course, increasing efforts at increased sanitation, cleaning more frequently, doing a ton of education to their guests and clients on disease transmission and why this matters. We're struggling, frankly, to offer all the supplies that are necessary to take education to the next step. You know, I think most of our systems, clients and consumers, like most Americans, understand the need for proper hygiene at this moment in time. But the supply chain disruptions that have made it hard for most Americans to get things like hand sanitizers and bleach wipes have actually been felt a little bit more significantly by a lot of the, you know, frontline providers just working on small budgets and those types of things. So we're making efforts there. One of the day shelters included a, purchased some outdoor sinks so that people could wash their hands with soap and water prior to entering. So a lot of work on just kind of, you know, educating people and then trying to provide the tangible services to let people use education.
You mentioned you're doing these weekly phone calls with organizations and service providers in the area. What are you discussing when you have those calls?
Kind of the way we're looking at it, like our basic agenda is start off with a little bit of resource sharing, although we're trying to do the bulk of that through email distribution lists. The COC just created a COVID-19 section on our website. We're going to start using Facebook to keep pushing information out real time to our partners. So the bulk of the meeting isn't just information sharing, but we do start off with that because it's so, you know, all of us know we watch the news and read the paper and listen to the radio, I should say. And, you know, it's fluid and it changes every day. So we're trying really hard to get information out there. So we start off with that. But then what we really go into is kind of a discussion of, okay, these are the best practices. We know that we are screening. But what do we do when we screen someone as at risk? What do we do when we screen someone who is, you know, we've called the system's frontline numbers for assessments, and the recommendation is that they would need to come in for testing. How do we safely get a person who's potentially contagious into a facility, to go to one of the clinics that, you know, the community clinic or UAMS or Northwest are setting up. So we're kind of, what we do is we're mapping out our problem areas and as best as we can working on resources. What can we share amongst ourselves? What can our partners do? And, you know, frankly, right now it is still more, the conversations often end with, that's a good issue, that's a real problem, and we're working on it. But people are going back and working on it. So we're trying to figure out how to best navigate that. So a lot of it is just that kind of, what are the needs we're seeing on the ground? And then how can we, whether it's like a healthcare agency, work on it? How can we as the COC try to serve as a liaison with the larger response system, with our philanthropic community, and just kind of share with them, we know it's important if someone's screened at risk to offer them a mask. Got to let you all know we're struggling to have access to masks, and everyone else is. We know that they don't, Department of Health isn't going to have a miracle for us, but making sure that other sectors know the challenges that our sector and our clients are facing.
Have there been any challenges in communicating information to some of our local vulnerable populations at all?
I think, our providers have good relationships with their clients. So I think that is one of our strengths. So we also do talk about our strengths. So we leverage that. One of our team members developed an info flyer written in English. We're working on a Spanish translation they partnered with at least Fayetteville Police that are going to start distributing the flyer where we've developed. So our outreach folks will be distributing them. We're trying to work with law enforcement. On the phone call today, after the phone call, someone from, I believe it was UAMS, shared some Marshallese language information flyers on COVID. So I think the information side is one of the stronger sides we have. I think like much of America right now, it is the how do we use information because the resources, our systems are stretched so thin.
And what about the rest of us? What can we do if we can offer some help?
Sure. So I think the two biggest areas of need we have, not surprising, they're kind of areas of need our sector has even in calmer days, but the need goes up when days become less calm, are financial contributions. We're working on the ability to Salvation Army, for example, has been doing fundraising so that when they have a guest in their shelter who has been screened as at risk and maybe they've been sent for testing, a test is pending, or they seem symptomatic, but they haven't yet hit the still narrow space with which the CDC guidelines allow testing, the Salvation Army is working on placing people in motels so they can be safe for themselves and not expose others to potential risk. So cash donations to agencies like the Salvation Army, Seven Hills, I mean, you know, the other broad array of, and I shouldn't just mention two, but there's, you know, there's a ton of agencies who would benefit, agencies that target family violence survivors. You know, not surprisingly, sadly, rates of DV are anticipated to go up significantly as the whole country is sheltering in place and stressful. So support agencies that do good work financially. And another really big challenge we have, and another particular a big initiative we're about to start that came out of today's call, was many of our agencies are having significant workforce disruptions. A lot of our agencies rely heavily on volunteers who are wonderful people, but are not exclusively, but disproportionately older adults, retirees who are making the totally understandable choice to stay at home and self-protect. So we're having challenges staffing our facilities, staffing our programs. And so what we started to talk about today, and we're also having impacts on just our paid workforce too, when you think about these schools closing, again, understandably, our employees have childcare obligations. So what we're going to start launching, and Seven Hills is going to take the lead on this, and their website has a good existing volunteer portal where we're trying to actively recruit younger volunteers, millennials, people who are not in an elevated risk group due to age or existing comorbidities, who we are going to partner with. Northwest Medical Center is offered to help out with some training on giving good safety tips and training guidance to these volunteers we're going to recruit with an eye. Again, even though it's going to work, we're going to use Seven Hills as the portal, trying to develop a volunteer base that's more flexible than normal, that can be kind of trans-organizational. So instead of someone volunteering with one agency, we have someone who can help, you know, drive people between places in a safe manner, or can deliver food to clients of a couple of different agencies who are being sheltered in a motel. So instead of each agency duplicating efforts and doing volunteer outreach, we're going to try really hard to coordinate this effort to bring in some younger, healthier, less at-risk volunteers that we can train well and then use to extend our services.
And I know we say this a lot lately, that times are just really strange and we're all trying to figure out how to navigate this new world we're living in right now. But is there something you want people to know about our local vulnerable populations from your work in this sector that maybe people aren't thinking about right now?
Sure. I mean, my guess is none of it's too surprising when people stop to think about it. But, you know, America, well, and the world, frankly, is going through a moment in time where we're all pretty focused on ourselves for understandable reasons. So just remembering that as stressful and challenging as this is for those of us with homes and with incomes, like most things, it hits the poor and marginalized harder. We really know from, you know, decades, if not centuries of research, epidemics are much, they're the brunts are borne harder by the poor, the sick, the socially marginalized, and we anticipate that. And then one other concern we have too, and it's I don't think it's going to be shocking to folks, but just to kind of lay it out, just as we're anticipating an increase in needs from our domestic violence partners. Just, you know, this public health crisis obviously has huge economic implications. We would not be surprised if there were more people needing services going forward. People are being laid off from work. People are being furloughed. We know that the feds are working on a stimulus package that will eventually come in and help. But in the interim, there's just that need. So at the same time that we're less able to respond, we anticipate the request for services going up. And that also falls in one other thing that folks can do if you're not in a position to donate money or donate time. You know, donate advocacy. There have been some efforts to, you know, do advocacy with the legislature or whoever the appropriate decision makers are, or individual landlords on, you know, look, encouraging, you know, moratoriums on evictions at this moment in time. So great advocacy opportunity for people to contact their state and federal representatives and encourage this type of flexibility so that we don't overburden an already overburdened system and overburden individuals.
Thank you very much for speaking with us. And I imagine this is hard work on a normal day, and we are definitely not having a lot of those lately.
It is. And thank you for your interest in this topic. It's important. Thanks to your listeners. And, you know, please do, you know, even though these are trying times for all of us, if you find yourself like me as someone with, you know, relative levels of comfort, let's think if there are things we can do to help.
That was John Gallagher, the chairman of the Continuum of Care and assistant professor at the School of Social Work at the University of Arkansas, speaking with Ozarks at Large's Zuzanna Sitek. The Continuum of Care is a nonprofit coalition of organizations and advocates whose goal is to end homelessness in the region. And if you'd like to know more about what is happening in the region regarding COVID-19, cancellations, alterations, and other news, you can keep up to date through the COVID-19 page at KUAF.com. This is Ozarks at Large.
When you listen to breaking national and local news on KUAF, you may not know what it takes to bring you that news. As our community begins grappling with abrupt cancellations, new discoveries about COVID-19, and the implications of social distancing, our local reporting team is gathering facts, asking the questions you want asked, checking and rechecking to make sure the information is accurate. With local newscasts every morning, daily updates on Ozarks at Large, and the Community Spotlight, KUAF is committed to bringing you accurate, updated information so you can better understand how this outbreak is affecting you and your community. The most important thing you can do for this work is to become a member today. Become a monthly donor or give a one-time gift to support our local reporting at supportkuaf.com. And thank you.
And as we continue a period of social distancing for an unknown period of time, KUAF has a new initiative to connect you to the rest of us. It's called KUAF Connects. It's a phone line dedicated to listener messages, from answers to questions about how you're preparing for an unknown future, to homeschooling, to reaching out to friends and loved ones, to a repository for messages to others in the community, to a place where listeners can submit questions of their own. We're borrowing from the leaders in call-in radio programs like 1A and Science Friday, and we're using KUAF Connects to share the diverse voices and opinions of our community with each other. As we lessen our physical contact with each other, knowing that there are still ways to engage becomes more and more important. From virtual dance parties to online yoga practices, KUAF is dedicated to not only bringing our listeners vitally important news and information, but also the stories and voices of your neighbors, of your colleagues, and friends. You can reach us on the KUAF Connects line and leave us a message. Tell us what you're doing, what's different in your life day to day, and just give us an uplifting message. 575-6577. We'll ask you for your name, where you're calling from, and then to leave a message. And again, the KUAF Connects number is area code 479-575-6577. This is Ozarks at Large. Two permit requests, one for a new large-scale industrial turkey farm near Dry Fork Creek, and another request to spread millions of gallons of industrial sludge on hay fields along War Eagle Creek, Both of these in Madison County were withdrawn last week, in part due to coordinated opposition by environmental watchdog groups. Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich reports.
Brian Thompson, a retired Tyson Information Systems project manager, is a board member of the Ozarks Society, formed in 1962 to protect the Buffalo National River. Ozarks Society is part of a larger coalition of regional environmental monitoring groups.
We do have people that keep an eye on ADEQ's new permits, but oftentimes, you know, people are busy and those don't get noticed.
One permit that didn't get much notice was submitted last summer to Arkansas Department of Environmental Quality by Denali Water Solutions, based in Russellville. The waste company sought to spread over 23 million gallons of agricultural industrial sludge annually, collected from the two-state region, on 1,000 acres of hay fields along War Eagle Creek, a tributary to the White River. A 30-day public comment period about that permit opened in early February and closed, Thompson says, with a full docket.
There were about 200 comments altogether, and they were all expressed concern. Now, I can't say that it might not have been one that I missed, but they all expressed concern in regard to the drinking water and Beaver watershed.
For two reasons, Thompson says. First, the sludge would be comprised of various wastes.
You know, there's a variety of chicken plants. There's cook plants. There's rendering. There's kill plants, further processing. There were also feed mills involved. There were some, septic management operations, like septic system, Roto-Rooter-type pump operations. So I think some of that waste was included as well. So it was a hodgepodge, and it was from industries from northwest Arkansas, southeast Oklahoma, and southern Missouri.
Human and animal waste can contain pathogens, bacteria, virus, and sometimes heavy metals. Karst is not mentioned in Denali's permit, which Thompson says is problematic. That's because sludge would be spread on what's called karst topography, thin Ozarks soils overlaying fractured limestone through which water quickly travels. According to comments in ADEQ's docket for this permit, property owners were concerned the sludge would impair their freshwater springs and wells.
The word karst in these kinds of permits, it's almost a dirty word. So karst definitely needs to be considered with these types of permits.
Decades back, Ozark farmers and industrialists would get little to no public scrutiny when applying for state operating permits and farm loans. Those days appear to be over. Environmentalists, concerned property owners, and recreationalists are monitoring agency websites and newspapers for such requests, swarming to block.
Beaver Water District, their main concerns were the geology and the fact that it was in the watershed, the drinking watershed of Beaver Lake that serves 380,000 people. So they were very concerned.
Ozark Society and others on the docket were demanding an extension from ADEQ to allow for more public comment when Denali's environmental manager suddenly withdrew their permit request on March 11th.
We were thrilled to death. As you know, there have been several fights recently over the CNH issues.
Referring to CNH hog farms in Newton County, an industrial swine breeding operation which was permitted by ADEQ in 2012 to spread 30 million gallons of hog waste annually near the Buffalo National River. The permit for CNH was eventually revoked several years ago.
The issues that we just finished going through with the hog farm concern that was in the Buffalo River watershed, that took 6 years to resolve, and we didn't want to get into another long-term issue like that. So we were very happy this resolved on its own.
We queried Denali Water Solutions about why they withdrew their permit application. We also asked, among other questions, why karst is not cited in their application and why aluminum flocculants used to filter out waste solids from industrial water is not listed. Denali declined talking by phone, but replied via email, saying it adheres to federal, state, and local regulations, and that withdrawing permits is routine for the company. A search of ADEQ's records reveals a litany of environmental citations against Denali, tracing back to when it operated under the name Terra Renewal. Near the time Denali withdrew its permit, another proposal by Davidson Turkeys to Arkansas Farm Service Agency was also withdrawn. Davidson, based in Huntsville, sought a permit for an industrial turkey farm on Dry Fork Creek in northern Madison County. The operation would have raised over 800,000 turkeys a year and land apply bird waste on local pastures. Also karst terrain, also on the White River watershed. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
A pair of health centers in our listening area are among 12 in Arkansas to receive coronavirus supplemental funding today from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. St. Francis House in Springdale will receive just under $101,000, and Health Connections in MENA will get almost $61,000. In all, the agency is providing more than $815,000 to Arkansas health centers. Talk Business and Politics reports two of the three largest hotels in Northwest Arkansas are suspending business. The Graduate Hotel in downtown Fayetteville suspended operations Friday, and the Holiday Inn Northwest Arkansas in Springdale is also suspending operations. The hotels have 204 and 206 rooms, respectively. As the number of coronavirus cases in Arkansas continues to rise, those involved with petition drives are finding it difficult to gather signatures. According to the 2020 Initiatives and Referenda Handbook from the Secretary of State's office, almost 90,000 signatures are needed for a petition proposing a constitutional amendment. Furthermore, signatures must come from 15 counties in Arkansas and be turned in by July 3rd. Melissa Foltz is the executive director of Arkansans for Cannabis Reform, which is behind the Arkansas Adult Use Cannabis Amendment, which would legalize recreational marijuana in the state. She says collection during the coronavirus pandemic has been slower, but a recent donation of $40,000 from Little Rock Normal should help with the hiring of canvassers.
We don't have the signatures we would like to have, but we still have plenty of time. With us being able to hire canvassers, we still have plenty of time to get signatures if this coronavirus will go away.
Since signatures must be collected face-to-face, another method Foltz says they are willing to try is to let the public know where they are going to be in order to collect the needed signatures.
We are going to try to see if we can send out letters in communities and tell them we will be here on this day. We will be going door to door. Our canvassers have been checked for health. They will take every precaution. They'll have hand sanitizers.
With the Arkansas Adult Use Cannabis Amendment, Foltz says as long as the team can begin canvassing again by May 1st, she thinks they should be in good shape.
Ozarks at Large is underwritten, in part, by the Walton Family Charitable Support Foundation.
Tomorrow on Ozarks at Large, Beaver Water District reminding the public it is still safe to drink tap water, even during a pandemic.
This drinking water is safe and it's very economical, and we would encourage everyone to utilize that tap water, that drinking water source from their cities.
Details on tomorrow's Ozarks at Large at noon and 7 and at ozarksatlarge.com. You can also stay up to date with our newscast every weekday morning at 5:30 and 7:30. Antoinette Grajeda provides news and information from around the region and state each Monday through Friday morning during Morning Edition. And on tomorrow's Morning Edition, the number of coronavirus cases growing, and so are fears that many healthcare workers will get sick. Now some states are making emergency changes to allow retired physicians to step in an all-hands-on-deck situation, though some say the risks are too great. Morning Edition, tomorrow morning from 5 to 9 on 91.3 KUAF. And also tomorrow morning, the Community Spotlight with Pete Hartman at 6:30 and 8:30 with news about how nonprofits here are coping with the pandemic. This is Ozarks at Large. Pets are becoming the new stars of business meetings. As people participate in virtual staff meetings on services like Zoom from home, the occasional bark can interrupt. A couple of weeks ago, our militant grammarian was already thinking about dogs when she came to the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio to discuss words and phrases inspired by our four-legged office mates.
I know you see some of my Facebook posts. Mm-hmm. If you've been tuned in since October, you know that I went through 3.5 months of hope and heartbreak in my mission to adopt a dog after my beloved Pearl died in late October.
Yes.
And you've seen way too many pictures of the two dogs I did adopt.
Let me just stop you there. If I say someone has posted way too many pictures of their dogs on social media, I am a hypocrite. So there cannot be way too many.
Well, the two dogs I adopted were a three-legged toy poodle named Roxy and a one-eyed cocker mix named Ruby.
Yeah, so perfect.
I wanted to tell you that when I had shown David the picture of Roxy and told him that she was three-legged, he immediately after that went on a trip, and he sent me a photo from the airport that when his suitcase arrived, it was missing a wheel.
So he's now calling that suitcase.
And he said that he wondered if it was fate.
That's fun.
So my experience got me to thinking about idioms featuring the word dog.
Oh, this will be fun.
Kyle, I'm going to tell you the idiom, and you tell me what it means. Gone to the dogs.
Whatever it is, a project, a life, a television show, it's just in disarray now.
Right. The idiom has more of a history than most, as it's believed to have originated in China, where in the past, dogs were not allowed within the city limits. They lived savagely on the outskirts of the city, eating garbage and being scorned or neglected by its citizens.
Times have changed.
So if someone has gone to the dogs, he has reached the lowest of the lows.
Sure.
Likened to the dogs of ancient China. Okay, it's a dog-eat-dog world.
We're all in it for our own selves. Do unto others what you would not want them to do to you.
Situations in which someone would do anything to be successful.
Yeah.
The phrase appears first in American books published near the beginning of the 20th century. The actual phrase was, dog does not eat dog.
Interesting.
Isn't that interesting?
Yeah,
that
somehow
you know,
got bastardized.
It's from an old Latin proverb from the 1500s that simply reads, a dog does not eat the flesh of a dog.
Huh.
The modern idiom directly contradicts the old Latin saying. This was first recorded in English in 1543. Thomas Fuller wrote in Nomologia.
That was the name of his publication.
Yeah.
Okay.
In 1732, dogs are hard drove when they eat dogs.
Oh, they're desperate.
Yeah.
It reminds me of my favorite joke from the television show Cheers. Remember Norm would walk in and Coach would say, Norm, how's it going?
Uh-huh.
And Norm one time said, it's a dog-eat-dog world, Coach, and I'm wearing milk bone underwear.
I hope none of our listeners are sick as a dog.
That's just about as sick as you can be.
Right.
You're just down for the count.
It's probably originated sometime in the 17th century where many dogs were left to roam the streets without care or attention. A bit later in history, sometime in the 19th century, the phrase sick as a parrot was coined.
Parrots live to be 130 years old.
This was apparently something to do with parrots on board Royal Navy ships.
Right.
You can't teach an old dog new tricks.
I suspect that's what Timothy Dennis says to other people who work on the show when they talk about teaching me something beyond cut and paste on a computer. It's, you know, whatever the situation, someone gets to a certain age, they're not going to learn how to do something new.
Right. From the early 16th century, it was coined in a literal sense and as advice to shepherds to train their dogs while they're young. And it's one of the oldest idioms in the English language.
Huh.
It's from John Fitzherbert's The Book of Husbandry, published in 1534. In the book, he writes about teaching a dog to bark and run on command and says these things must be taught when he is a puppy.
Sure.
Well, I have my dogs are 4 years old and 8 years old, and I was almost late this morning because I could not get the four-year-old to come inside.
Well, that's the next 8 years.
I cannot teach old dogs. Okay, what about hair of the dog?
Oh, have a hangover? You know, go for whatever puts
Bloody
you in that.
Mary.
Right. Now, see, when I was in college, we thought, whatever, that whatever it was that got you there, so if you had imbibed too much on gin or beer, that's what you had
mm-hmm. to get you mm-hmm. over mm-hmm. it.
That reminds me of telling somebody at a meeting the other day, when I was in college, I was a terrible student, and so we had suite mates, you know, mm-hmm. and the night before a test, we'd get out the Ouija board.
Okay.
And if we'd ask the Ouija board, am I going to pass the test? And if it said yes, we didn't study because we're going to pass the test. And if it said no, we didn't study because what use was studying if we weren't going to pass the test? I had very poor yes. GPA that semester.
You really didn't need the Ouija board,
no,
did you?
No, no, I didn't. Okay, so the phrase of hair of the dog is actually short for hair of the dog that bit me. I'm mm-hmm. You've heard that, which comes from the Middle Ages when it was thought that placing dog hairs on a bite from a rabid dog would cure the injury. It's
well, it's just that whether we're talking that one or the one that I tried in college, neither works.
No, no, that's right. It's been associated with a hangover cure since the 16th century.
Huh.
Okay, dog days or the dog days of summer?
When it's just so hot, you don't want to do anything.
Right. The idiom dog days or dog days of summer is another one with ancient origins. The ancient Egyptian New Year began with the rise of the Nile in June, when Sirius, the dog star,
right.
would appear just
right.
before sunrise.
Of course.
Dog days of summer.
Yes.
The ancient Greeks and Romans thought that the intense heat of the dog days was produced by the joint powers of Sirius and the sun. In antiquity, the dog days were a time of ill omen.
Mm. Mm.
The Old Farmer's Almanac says the dog days are the 40 days beginning on July 3rd and ending on August 11th.
Well, the Old Farmer's Almanac just says whatever it wants to. It's going to snow. It's not going to snow. That's my favorite time of year.
The dog days?
Yes.
Oh, my gosh. Do you stay inside?
I mean, I will admit that I live in a time of air conditioning, mm-hmm. so that makes it. But, no, I love heat. I love
really?
Humidity.
Mm. My favorite, my heavens. Are you in the right place?
My favorite time of year is when going to work in the morning from my house to my car, my shirt is already sticking to my back.
Wow.
I feel so much more energetic. So
do you like saunas?
I do.
Yeah.
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 And I like space heaters, and I like them in August. But I don't use them because of climate change.
Because people think you're too weird. All right. Dogs are also used to talk about cold weather.
Oh.
Three dog night.
It's so cold, you got to get all three dogs in the bed with you.
That's right. It is believed that the phrase originated with the Australian Aborigines. When it was a cold night, they would cuddle with a dog in their bed to keep warm. If it was bone-chilling cold, it might take three dogs to keep warm.
Gotcha.
What about dog tired?
Well, it means very tired. And I personally specifically think of it after you've traveled. You've done the flight.
Mm-hmm.
You've turned in the rental car or you've come back and you get home. That's mm-hmm. when I think of dog tired.
Yeah. Legend has it that we can thank Alfred the Great, King of Wessex in Great Britain from 871 to 899, for our use of the adjective dog tired to mean utterly exhausted. Mm. Listen to this dude. Alfred would send his sons, Athelbrod and Edwin, out hunting with his extensive kennels of hunting dogs. Whichever son caught the most hounds would be rewarded by being seated at his father's right-hand side at the dinner table that weekend. These chases would leave the boys dog-tired.
So think about poor Athelbrod, because yeah. you've got kind of a jerk for a dad.
Yeah.
And you're named Athelbrod.
We just called him Ath.
Ah.
It's a good story, but evidence for dog tired only dates to the 1700s. Shakespeare used dog weary in his Taming of the Shrew, written in the 1590s.
Hmm.
Finally, Kyle, here are a couple of dog idioms with origins related to war.
Okay.
Let slip the dogs of war.
That's Shakespearean, but I have no idea from what or what it means.
You know, I didn't either. I had always
yeah.
heard it. And I heard it last night on Big Bang Theory from you know who.
Yeah, Sheldon.
From Sheldon, yeah. But it's to cause disorder and confusion.
I remember George Will using it once in a column, and I thought, well, there's something George Will knows that I don't.
Shakespeare's most famous doggy line of verse is from Julius Caesar, and goes like this: "Cry havoc and let slip the dogs of war."
Right. Which, when you think about Caesar saying it, sounds kind of ominous.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Absolutely. This may refer to ancient warfare. Shakespeare is imagining his hero unleashing a horde of warriors to cause total chaos for his enemies. Now, the tail that wagged the dog.
I had a hard time. I had a very good friend whose first language was not English ask me about this idiom and to explain it. And it was harder for me to explain than I thought it would be. It's the thing that you should be controlling is actually controlling the situation.
Yeah, yeah. That's the meaning of it. But absolutely. But, I mean, visually or in your imagination, you can see the dog when it's wagging its tail so hard that it wags the body.
Right.
Tail wagging the dog was used as a political reference in the 1800s, meaning that something small or insignificant is controlling the whole shebang. To wag the dog means to purposely divert attention from what would otherwise be of greater importance to something of lesser importance. And how do we know wag the dog?
Well, I mean, there was a film not too long ago. Mm-hmm. Well, 20 years ago.
1997.
All right. Wow, really?
Yeah.
That's more than 20 years ago. Uh-huh. Okay.
but what was it? What was it about?
It was a political thriller / satire. It was about war, right? Mm-hmm. Going to war and...
Intentionally starting a war for political purposes.
Yes.
By doing so, the lesser significant event is catapulted into the limelight, drowning proper attention to what was originally the more important issue.
Right, the distraction. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You're right.
The expression comes from a saying that a dog is smarter than its tail. But if the tail were smarter, then the tail would wag the dog.
Right, okay.
The expression wag the dog was elaborately used as the theme of the movie Wag the Dog, a 1997 film starring Robert De Niro and Dustin Hoffman.
Yep.
Well, there are many, many more of these dog idioms, but I'm dog tired.
Catherine Sherrills is our militant grammarian.
Who let the dogs out? Hoot, 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 hoot. Who let the dogs out? Hoot, 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 hoot. Who let the dogs out? Hoot, 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 hoot. Who let the dogs out?
Well, the party was nice, the party was pumping.
Hey, yeah.
Yippee-yi-yo.
And everybody having a ball.
Yippee-yi-yo.
The fellas start the name calling.
Yippee-yi-yo.
And the girls respond to the call. I have a poor white shout out.
This is 91.3 KUAF, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Rogers, and Pocola, Oklahoma. 91.3 KUAF, a listener-supported service of the J. William Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas. Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF and is produced at the Carver Center for Public Radio and in home studios all across the region. Another heartfelt thank you to my colleagues here making radio happen. And a big thank you to all of you making sure we continue in difficult times in your work, your parenting, your community support. Let's keep checking on our neighbors and supporting those of us in need. Let us know how you're doing by calling our KUAF Connects line at 575-6577. You might hear yourself on the air. You can keep up to date with the news regarding how coronavirus is affecting the region and the state with our COVID-19 page at KUAF.com. Contributors today included Antoinette Grajeda, Zuzana Sitek, and Jacqueline Froelich. Our show was mastered by Timothy Dennis from his home in Fayetteville. Additional material today came from our hardworking friends at KUAR Public Radio in Little Rock. All right, our theme is written and performed by Daryl Sean. His most recent CD is titled Safe in Sound. The All Things Considered an NPR National Conversation comes up next on 91.3 KUAF, a program to help explain what's new in the world of COVID-19. That's beginning at 8 tonight and every Monday through Friday night for the foreseeable future. Stay well, stay safe. Thanks for spending part of your Tuesday night with us back tomorrow.